Good morning, and thanks very much for coming to the program today on the dishonest client. Just by way of explanation, because I see some people here who are new. So my name is Mordechai Turchiner, and I'm with the Yeshiva University Torah Mitzion Beit Midrash Zifron Dov. And we are a rabbinic training program. We have rabbinical students from Yeshiva University in New York, as well as from Israel, who come study with us. We're based in the Boys High School, Yeshivat Or Chaim, which is in the Clinton Park area. In addition to training rabbinical students, we are also also run classes with the high school students at Yeshivat Or Chaim, as well as their sister school, Ulpanat Orot. We also work with university students who come study with us in our Beit Midrash at Yeshivat Or Chaim. And then when I'm not involved with the rabbinical students, the high school students, the university students, I'm also charged with giving classes around the community on topics that touch on the ideals of Yeshiva University as well as Torah Mitzion. And this topic, the legal ethics topic and the intersection of Torah with the professional lives of, in this case, lawyers. We also have classes for doctors, accountants, and so on. But that fits definitely the mandate of Yeshiva University for Jews to be familiar with the ways in which Torah impacts on and can impact on their professional lives. So our topic for this morning is the dishonest client. And actually, before I launch into the topic, there is a sign-in sheet going around. Please do sign in. If you're doing this for credits, we are approved for 1.25 professionalism credits through for CPD. You don't actually get a letter from us. The way it works is that there's the online portal and you file there. We are listed there. However, they may contact us to verify that you were here. So please make sure that that you signed in. And even if you're not doing this for credits, it's good to sign in because I like to follow up afterwards on items that come up within the talk, questions that come up that I'm not able to answer at that moment. So I like to follow up by email. I also expect to send out the digital version of the source sheets afterwards to those who sign in. I know that we didn't have enough copies for everybody. I'm glad. That means that we overshot expectations. But I'm sad for the people who don't have copies of the source sheet. So if you could please make sure to sign in, that would be great. The sign-in sheet is where currently? It is. You're making another one. Okay, great. Thank you. Thank you, Michael. Okay. So what we're going to discuss for the next hour to an hour and a quarter is the challenge that a lawyer faces when the client comes to the lawyer with a request, a retainer, and the lawyer suspects that something is going on that is inappropriate. And we could give many different scenarios. I always get in trouble when I give scenarios to lawyers. Because inevitably people come up with questions and points and the scenario falls apart. So I don't really want to get myself into trouble. So yes, I'll present. Yeah, go ahead. Exactly. I'm gonna present just a basic case, which you can feel free to shoot down. But let's say you are a lawyer who. No, you know what? I'm not going to present a case just to get shut down. It'll be fine. The case that we're dealing with is that the person who approaches the lawyer says things that the lawyer believes are questionable in terms of the basic facts that are being given. The lawyer feels that the client is being dishonest with a goal of defrauding somebody. So the question is, what is the lawyer's obligation in that circumstance? Now, there are many ramifications of this, and it's a very broad topic. I was just reading a paper the other day that discussed the question of a lawyer in a negotiation where the client asks the lawyer to withhold certain information. There are all sorts of side topics that can come up out of this. We're going to stick to a fairly narrow frame because of the time frame that we're working with. And so we're going to ask the question of, number one, within the rules of the LSUC, the Law Society of Upper Canada, as well as within Jewish law, what is my obligation vis-a-vis my own conduct and the conduct of my client? And along with that, I want to ask three particular sub-questions. Question number one is prevention. When I know my client is planning to defraud investors, for example, but without using my help, I won't be involved in the fraud, but I know that that's what's going on. So I'll actually end up getting to a particular case that happened. It's a fairly straightforward case. You had a lawyer who was, or a law firm that was approached by somebody, and he wanted to give them money to, he was going to put into their trust fund, and then eventually he was going to use the funds. And the law firm did this, and they didn't investigate the fellow. They knew the fellow from someone's cousin, that sort of thing. And then it turned out that the money that was put in there was actually money he had solicited from investors for a scheme that did not exist. But the law firm didn't know that. They had never investigated. They just knew he gave them money, and that eventually he spent that money. And the case eventually came to trial because the people who were his investors, who had been cheated, sued the law firm and said, well, you should have investigated. So that's a case that we're actually going to come back to a little bit later. But let's say I know, or I suspect, let's say I know my client is planning to defraud investors. What are my responsibilities? That's the first sub-question. Second sub-question is the issue of default credibility, where I am approached by a potential client. Let's say, once in the case I just gave, he wants to use my trust fund. Am I entitled to assume honesty? Or am I required to investigate? And then the third question is, from a livelihood perspective, am I obligated to leave my job rather than violate my ethical responsibility? So those are the three sub-questions that I'd like to deal with. And again, we're going to deal with it from the perspective of law society rules, as well as from the perspective of Jewish law, Jewish tradition. So we begin, and by the way, please interrupt at any time. That's fine. If I see that it's getting to be too much, then we'll lose our time frame, then I'll have to cut it off. But otherwise, interrupt, please. So the principle of not participating in or aiding unethical conduct appears in both the Law Society's rules of professional conduct and in Jewish law. There is a duty to help one's client, and that's sort of the default position. A lawyer is responsible to help his client. If you take a look at source number one, simple item out of the most recent version of the Rules of Professional Conduct, a lawyer has a duty to provide courteous, thorough, and prompt service to clients. The quality of service required of a lawyer is service that is competent, timely, conscientious, diligent, efficient, and civil. So that's the default responsibility, is to take care of a client's needs. Now, within Jewish law, you don't actually have historically a position of lawyer. There was, already going back to Talmudic times, the idea of someone who would help a person to arrange their claim, what's called in Talmudic language, Orchei Hadayanim. And in fact, today, the term in Hebrew for a lawyer is Orech Din. So, that's borrowed from there. There was such a possibility of being someone who would help a person to prepare their claim. But it wasn't an official, it wasn't an officer of the court. Didn't have any standing, actually, with the court. It was just somebody you went to because they knew stuff. So you aren't going to find, in the same way that you find for the Law Society, you aren't going to find an official Code of Jewish Law statement saying a lawyer has a responsibility to help clients. However, what you do have is the basic obligation that we have towards other human beings to assist them when they are in need, having nothing to do with any professional role. So in source number two, I brought you one codification of it just because I think it's a good presentation for us. Rabbi Moses Maimonides, Rambam, in his Mishneh Torah, his work of law, it's actually in Hilchot Avel, the laws of the mourner, writes, Mitzvah Daseh Shel Divrehem, there is a rabbinic obligation to examine the sick, to comfort mourners, to bring out the dead for burial, to bring in the bride for a wedding, to escort guests, and so on and so forth. The emphasis in the paragraph is more on burial because that's the context where this law appears, the laws of the mourner. And so I skipped a little bit within his paragraph as he details some of the practices engaged in the process of burial. And he concludes by saying, Aval Pisha Kol Mitzvos Elo Midivrehem, even though all of these obligations are rabbinic, rather than biblical, they're included in the classic biblical mandate, V'ahavta l'reacha kamocha, you shall love your neighbor as yourself. You have an obligation to take care of others. And so, from a Jewish perspective, even though I don't have an official position of lawyer who is obligated to help clients, nonetheless, I have a general mandate that if I am able to help somebody else, I am obligated to do so. And that's my starting point, and that's why one would say you know, you should be helping the client and you shouldn't be questioning and so on, but there are grounds to override that, and that's what brings us to our discussion about the unethical client. So, yes?
Is this applicable here? The situation we're talking about is a commercial relationship as opposed to a custodian.
Right, so that's why I emphasized before, this is even if it's not professional. If it is professional, then there's an additional responsibility. If I signed an agreement with somebody that says I'm going to represent them, so now I also have a separate obligation to fulfill my word in the contract. I was being very broad here. But yes, you're right, I could have also noted that there's a contractual obligation in the event that you actually enter into such a relationship. So yeah, that's true. Thank you. So, what are the rules then in the event that this client who I have a duty to serve is engaged in unethical conduct? So the LSUC rules are very clear. No participation, no assistance. If you take a look at source number 3, rule 3.2-7, a lawyer shall not knowingly assist in or encourage any dishonesty, fraud, crime, or illegal conduct, or instruct a client or any other person on how to violate the law and avoid punishment. So what we see here is, number one, active assistance and advice. Right? The lawyer is not allowed to tell the client how to be able to get away with whatever it is that's involved, is not allowed to engage in the dishonesty or engage in the fraud. The lawyer also is not allowed to encourage it. Right? He can't give any indication that this is something that the client should go forward and do. We have a parallel rule within Jewish law that says that I am not allowed to participate in or assist wrongdoing. The issue of actively assisting in and advising comes under two basic headings in Jewish law. The first is called misayea, and the second is called lifnei iver. Misayea means to assist. And I am not allowed to assist in wrongdoing, and lifnei iver means not to put a stumbling block in front of the blind, and by advising someone in how to do things that are bad, or by encouraging someone to do that, I am potentially causing somebody to stumble, somebody being my client, because I'm causing him to be able to engage in wrongdoing. If you take a look at source number 4, I give you an example of indirect involvement. This is dealing with the case of stolen goods. Ein lochin min haroim lo izim velo gedayim velo gizin velo tolushin shel tzemer. The arrangement they used to have historically for shepherds, I don't know how many people here have ever been shepherds, but but shepherding has actually changed over time. But the way they used to do the shepherding arrangement was that you would take your animals, whatever those animals were, you would give them to the shepherd, and the shepherd would keep them for a season. It wasn't like you had your own shepherds on staff who were taking... get that? Shepherds on staff. That was not intended. It was not as though you had your own shepherds and the shepherds were responsible for taking care of your flocks, but there was a professional shepherd, and the professional shepherd would take control of your animals and have them for the season and eventually bring them back, and therefore you had to have some kind of an agreement with the shepherd for whatever might happen during that period of time, because after all, the animal may give birth. What is the status of the young? The animal produces milk regularly. What's the status of the milk? The animal needs to be sheared. What's the status of the wool? And so you had certain default arrangements. And among the default arrangements, it was understood that the shepherd was not entitled to the young and was not entitled to the wool. And therefore, the Talmud here states, as the text going back a couple of thousand years, Ein lochin min haroim, you're not allowed to buy off of a shepherd, you average person who doesn't own animals. You're not allowed to buy off of a shepherd young animals or wool or tufts of wool because of concern that it's stolen. It's not, he's not entitled to it. It came off of the animals that were in his care. Of a lochin man tefurin, if they're stitched clothing, that you can buy off of them, if neshein shalahen, because the assumption is that that's actually his own. We don't assume that the shepherd is also a tailor, or has some kind of an operation with a tailor, where he's funneling the wool to the tailor, getting back stitched clothing, and then bringing it to market. Although it's not a bad idea. Yeah. It is a bad idea, but you know what I'm saying. That's called encouraging. But he says you're not allowed to do that. V'lo k'mehen chalav u'gvina b'midbar v'lo b'yishuv. You are allowed to buy from them milk and cheese if he's out in the wild. Because the assumption is that if he's grazing them far from the community, then odds are that he's actually licensed to use the milk and the cheese for himself, because what's he going to do? Is he going to store it all before the owner comes to him? So odds are it's his. But if he's in an urban area, then the assumption is that he made a deal with the owner of the animals that he was actually going to provide them with the milk and the cheese as well. And therefore you're not allowed to buy this off of them out of concern that it might be stolen. What's my point in bringing you these laws about shepherds and stolen goods? Take a look at source number 5, right? Moses Maimonides, writing 800 plus years ago, codifies this in his work of law. And he says, Asur liknos davar ha-gazul min ha-gazlan. You're not allowed to buy stolen goods from a thief. And he goes through the items that we talked about in source number 4, and he says that if you were to do that, if you were to buy stolen goods, then you would be, as he puts it, machzik yidei ovrei averas, strengthening the hands of sinners, and be violating the law of do not put a stumbling block before the blind. In other words, doing something that encourages impropriety is itself prohibited as lifnei iver lo sitein mechshol, don't put a stumbling block before the blind. Now, I could have argued against Maimonides, this person isn't blind, right? The shepherd knows exactly what he's doing. The shepherd has the animals, he knows it's wrong, he knows he has an agreement not to take the animals for himself. Nonetheless, encouraging wrongdoing, according to Maimonides, comes under that prohibition. So I am not allowed to encourage wrongdoing. I am not allowed to engage in wrongdoing. And I think that's self-evident from the fact that he has to tell you not to encourage it. So clearly you're also not allowed to do it. So on that basis, I shouldn't be involved in aiding, abetting, or encouraging. And I brought another example regarding encouraging. If you take a look at source number 6, this is a passage out of the Talmud, a story regarding a king by the name of Agrippus. Now, we're not going to get into all the details of Agrippus, but Agrippus was a king during the period towards the end of the Second Temple when the Jews are living under basically Roman rule, is more or less what we're talking about, without getting into the political fine points of what was going on then. But Agrippus was an illegitimate king. And you read the passage here in source number 6, and Agrippus reads a biblical verse that says, you shall only place, the verse says, you shall not place a stranger upon yourself, meaning as your king. Do not put a stranger upon yourself. And his eyes run with tears. He's very upset. And the sages say to him, don't be afraid. Do not be upset. Achinu ata, you are our brother. You are our brother. They say, don't worry about it, Agrippus. You're okay. To which, on that Mishnah, which is a lesson that, you know, again, we're going back to Roman times for this, there's an expansion by the sages in the Gemara, and they say, at that moment, the enemies of Israel, which is a term I put in quotes, because it's referring to the sages themselves, and calling them the enemies of Israel, they became liable for destruction, for flattering Agrippus. They were not allowed to flatter him in his role as the king, saying, well, it's okay, Agrippus, you're all right. You're not allowed to engage in that kind of flattery. And the reason for it, according to source number 7, which is a commentary to the Talmud recorded, as I wrote there, in 13th century France/Germany, is because by flattering him, they strengthen him in what he's doing. It encourages him. It says to him, you can actually go ahead and engage in this inappropriate behavior, and we are behind you. It would have been better for them to be silent. So what we have is, I'm not allowed to engage in wrongdoing. I'm not allowed to encourage wrongdoing, whether in terms of law society rules or in terms of Jewish tradition. Can we accept that? Is that okay? Or questions on that? Okay, so the truth is, though, that while the practical instructions are the same in terms of law society and Jewish tradition, their roots are different, and because the roots are different, there will be differences in the application. The root, in terms of the law society, is professional. It's about the duties, the allegiances that come with my duties as a lawyer. So, for example, if you take a look at source number 9 from a work called The Legal Research Guide to Ethics. This is by a fellow named Eric Appleby. So he writes, a lawyer is an officer of the court, which requires a standard of conduct that includes a special duty to maintain and uphold the law. Straightforward. I can't engage in unethical behavior if I am an officer of the court. I am supposed to maintain and uphold the law. In addition to that, I also have an obligation to myself. And here there's a quote which I've seen in a few different places from someone named Lord Burkett. And I have to admit, not being familiar with Lord Burkett personally, in terms of knowing his background, only that what he has said has been quoted in a variety of cases. And in source number 10, I brought it from one of them. The advocate has a duty to his client, a duty to the court, and a duty to the state. But he has above all a duty to himself. And he shall be, as far as lies in his power, a man of integrity. No profession calls for higher standards of honor and uprightness, and no profession perhaps offers greater temptations to forsake them. Now, I'm not sure I agree with him in his last sentence, that no profession calls for higher standards and no profession offers greater temptations to forsake them. I don't know. That seems very noble, but I'm not sure I'd agree with that, even in a room full of lawyers. But his point, and that's the end of what they quote in their citations of him. So I don't know how a sentence ends. But the point in bringing this is to say that from a law society perspective, your obligation to be ethical is part of your duties as officer of the court. But it's also a recognition that you have a responsibility to yourself. So even though you have a responsibility to serve the client professionally, contractually, there's an obligation to yourself that has precedence. Now, one thing I did want to note, because I mentioned professionally, if you go back for a second to source number 3, there was a fine point there which deserves to be brought out in the way that the LSCC writes this rule. A lawyer shall not knowingly assist in or encourage any dishonesty, fraud, crime, or illegal conduct, or instruct a client or any other person on how to violate the law and avoid punishment. So according to what I'm reading here, and correct me if I'm wrong, but I think this is a proper read, it isn't just a professional responsibility of when I'm functioning as a lawyer for an individual, I am not allowed to engage in or promote dishonest conduct. But when somebody is a lawyer, they have an automatic rule that they can't help anybody engage in dishonest conduct. So, for example, I am in the supermarket and I run into a friend of mine, and a friend of mine says, you know, I'd like to do this. I'm involved in this case and I'd like to say that. What do you think? You think I can do that? He's not your client. You're still not allowed to, from a law society perspective, you're still not allowed to engage in or to assist in or to encourage dishonesty. Is that a correct read of what it's saying? You a lawyer? Sorry? I mean, yeah, that's what it's saying. It's not only within the professional capacity. It's in general. That's
actually it is in a professional capacity. That's the point, because if the person's approaching you precisely because you're a lawyer, you might have been able to figure out a way to get around the problem.
Right.
In a manner which is illegal.
Right. Good point. I should not distinguish between professional and personal, but between contractual and non-contractual. That would be a better way to phrase it. Thank you. Okay. From a Jewish tradition perspective, the root of my prohibition against engaging in encouraging unethical, dishonest behavior is a religious one. It's about the allegiances that come with my duties as a Jew. I am not allowed to participate in impropriety. I'm not allowed to encourage impropriety. And even though I have an obligation of help other people, which includes all the things that Maimonides listed earlier, I have a greater obligation towards God. And that is best summed up, I think, by what I brought you in source number 11. Source number 11 is a passage out of the Talmud. Yeah?
Can I just go back to the acclimated to.
Yeah.
Or different people in the market.
Yeah.
Some of them find that it's stolen goods. So it's definitive that you know that it's stolen goods. Whereas the Gemara says, said that we were making the presumption that there was stolen.
Right. No, that's in the ellipsis. He brought the case in source number 4. In other words, Maimonides does include the case where I don't know for sure. We're coming to that. It's a good question. The question was asked here, that Maimonides, in the part that I excerpted, did not mention the case of uncertainty where I don't know, you know, for sure that whatever the shepherd has is actually stolen. We're going to come back to that. Maimonides does include it. It's just I didn't include it a second time because I'd included it in the source right before it. But in terms of the overall question, the question of we have an idea in Jewish tradition of judging others favorably. What does that do to this? We're going to come to that, God willing, very soon. Yes. Am I implying that Jewish law... I see what you're asking. So, interesting. Let me distinguish in two ways. The question is, would a non-Jew be allowed then to assist? And the short answer is yes. Jewish law does provide laws that apply to all human beings, but the law of Lifnei Iver, of not to cause him to stumble... is a requirement upon a Jew specifically. A Jew is not allowed to help a non-Jew violate his laws. In other words, my obligation as a Jew of don't make someone stumble or don't help someone stumble applies to all human beings, whether they are Jew or non-Jew. But a non-Jew doesn't have this obligation. However, as we're discussing this, I'm actually second-guessing, and I'll tell you why. There is one of the mitzvot, one of the commandments that applies to Jews and non-Jews, is dinin, the mitzvah of setting up courts. In its most limited interpretation, that means just courts to handle the 7 Noahide laws, not to kill people, not to steal, those sorts. In a more broad interpretation, which is subject to debate, it actually means to set up a judicial system in general to handle all sorts of issues in society. I could argue that if a lawyer is in fact an officer of the court, then the obligation of Lifnei Iver, of not causing someone to stumble in his actions as a lawyer, may well pertain, that he wouldn't be allowed to do it either. But I don't know. That's just a thought that's occurring to me now. I'd have to think that through more carefully. Yes? Right. Right, that's certainly true. If the case that's involved is itself financial, and one of the laws that apply to all human beings is not to steal, then theoretically it may come under that as well. I'm just not sure how broad we go in the Lifnei Iver. That's my... Right. Right. Certainly it would apply to being involved directly. In other words, if he was actually engaged in the fraud itself, that would be a problem. In terms of encouraging somebody else, that would be a very interesting question. I'm not sure. It's one of those things that I will think about and, God willing, be back in touch with those who sign in on the email, on the sign-in sheet, which is somewhere in the room. Where's the sign-in sheet? Okay, just please make sure if you haven't, then you'll get whatever further comments I have on that. Yes?
Sorry, the Rambam said that the reason why they saved Shem was Chayavisa, because they saw that Shem did something wrong, and they didn't bring him to justice, so they were in violation of that principle that you said.
Yes.
Didn't. So they not only are they not allowed to help him, they're taking the task for not intervening and bringing him to justice.
Right, the question that's asked is that there's a biblical case in which the city of Shechem is indeed punished because of a rape that occurs in the city, and one of the justifications that's offered for why this punishment is brought upon them is because they knew about it and they didn't bring the people involved to justice. Would that then indicate Lifnei Iver? I'm not so sure. I'm not so sure that that would still translate into this. The requirement that there be justice... doesn't necessarily. I want to think it through and respond to the email list once I've had a chance to think it through. I'm not sure. So what we have. I was about to read number 11. I was talking about within Jewish tradition the idea that a religious duty a duty to God will precede my duties to others. So they're talking here, the context here is a discussion about returning lost objects. The rule, in fact, is a biblical law that says I am obligated to return objects that I find that are lost. If the owner's given up hope, that's a separate discussion. We're not getting into the intricacies of those laws. The point is, rather, that I'm only obligated to return the lost object if doing so would not cause me to violate some other law. So they give you the following hypothetical case. There is, within the Jewish people, there's a group of people who are called Kohanim, priests. And one of the rules of the priests is they're not allowed to come in contact with the dead. So what happens if I am a Kohen? I'm actually not. Neither Kohen nor lawyer. Let's say I'm one of these priests, and I'm passing by a cemetery, and I look in, and I see an object that belongs to somebody else that was lost. I am not allowed to go in and become impure in order to get the object. I have to tell somebody else, let somebody else go in and get the object. I can't do it myself. So take a look, please, at source number 11. The Talmud asks, Minayin, how do we know that if one's father says to him, remember that his father, there's a mitzvah of honor your father and mother, so if his father says to him, Hitamei, become impure in order to get the lost object, break the law in order to do this. Osha'amar lo al tachzir, or the opposite extreme. I see a lost object and my father says to me, I don't want you to return that object. Break the law, don't restore the lost object to its owner. How do I know that I'm not supposed to listen to him? Because there's a biblical verse, Ish imo v'aviv tiro v'es shab sosai tishmoru. There's a biblical verse that says, you should revere your father and mother, or as it's worded there, actually, it's funny, the translation that I did was incorrect, your mother and father, mother is listed first. You should revere your mother and father, and you should guard my Sabbath. So from that we understand that the mother and father are also obligated to honor God, and therefore they can't ask me to violate my duty to God. Extrapolating from there, which is a safe extrapolation because it does apply beyond father and mother for reasons beyond the scope of where we're going, but in general, I have a duty to God that precedes my duties to other people. So even though we've said that I have an obligation of chesed, of generally helping others, and even though I may even have a contractual obligation with somebody, that cannot supersede the covenant that I entered into at Mount Sinai when I became a Jew, as Jews did in general at Mount Sinai, which said I'm going to first deal with my duties to God. So whether law society or halacha, Jewish law, either way, there is an obligation to be ethical that supersedes the obligation to the client. I have to honor in either law society rules, as far as the law society is concerned, or Torah, as far as Jewish tradition is concerned, over and above my duty to the client. The difference is, from the law society perspective, it's about my professional duties. From a Jewish perspective, it's a religious obligation. Now we get into our three sub-questions. Because I think really, probably everybody sitting here could have given, you know, the last half hour of material. It's all relatively straightforward. Don't be bad, or, you know, be good, as we like to say. But now we get into the prevention question as the first. And again, the question is this, and I'm going to put it to you first. Where I know my client is planning to defraud investors, okay, like the case that I gave before. Okay, let's say, like the case I gave before, where I, as a lawyer, have a trust fund, and someone wants to use the trust fund, but not like the case I gave before where the lawyer doesn't know. Let's say the lawyer does know that the person who's going to be putting money into that trust fund and taking the money out is getting it by telling people that they should come invest in his gold mine or whatever it is, and there is no gold mine. So is the lawyer obligated to prevent this, even though, or actually even better than that, because there it's my trust fund, and in the case of the trust fund, he actually is using me personally. So let's say I don't know that. Let's say my client is looking to me to help him with some separate matter. However, I know that my client is also going to be engaged in some kind of inappropriate behavior, defrauding investors. So I am not a tool. My trust fund is not a tool. I am not involved in this particular aspect of his business. He is not using me or my services in order to further his business. Do I have an obligation to prevent it anyway? What do you say? Yechiel says yes. Esther says,
you have an obligation to prevent your clients to the best of your ability.
have an obligation to try to convince the client not to engage in it. What if the client refuses? Right. Right. So Esther points out, you are not acting for him in the fraudulent area at all. Right. So in terms of withdrawing, I mean, there is a whole set of rules for when you can withdraw or when you can't, depending on circumstances particular to the case. But to add to what Esther is saying, there is an obligation. So let me add to and expand what Esther is saying based on my understanding, and correct me when I get it wrong. The rule, in fact, is, and we discussed this when we had a lecture on confidentiality, but the general rule is that I am supposed to try to convince him to do things that are right and not to do things that are wrong. Beyond that, I am not allowed to report it to others unless it involves concern for serious bodily harm, which also includes psychological harm, and we'll get to that in a moment. If it's an organization that I'm working for, a corporation that I'm working for, then I also have the duty to report it up the ladder to whoever is overarching. However, if I go all the way up the ladder and nobody's listening, my obligation ends there. Unless we're dealing with a serious bodily harm case, the obligation ends at that point, and I don't have an obligation to withdraw because I'm not part of this. I'm not part of this particular scheme. Joey, what were you going to add? Correct. The rule of which part of it? So I would just modify slightly what you just said. I'm not allowed to report outside of that corporation. I'm not allowed to report unless it's serious bodily harm. Not just I'm not obligated to, I'm not allowed to. In the event that it's serious bodily harm, I am allowed to, but not obligated to. That's actually the way that this is structured, for reasons I'll get back to in a moment. But yes, the question of, well, I'm not personally involved, that's true, but I think that nonetheless, I still am supposed to report it up the chain, because I'm aware of the corporation for which I am working being engaged in impropriety, even without my services. Yes?
Sorry, source number 3 says that the lawyer should not assist or encourage.
Yeah.
So where are we getting the idea from that he's supposed to discourage as well?
Right, so I'm going to get to it in Law Society rules in a second, but if you want to look ahead at number 13, that would be part of it. I'm sorry, number 14. But there was another question? Yeah.
Would there be a distinction of how you came about to know? Like, if it came about through the solicitor-client relationship,
yes.
One thing.
Good point.
In the open, something like that. If you
right.
learn about it through that specific relationship, then shouldn't the rule apply?
Yes, thank you for pointing that out. These rules apply to information I learn in my professional capacity. If I learn about it from something completely different, then these rules are not going to pertain. That's true. And when I say professional capacity, I mean the contractual capacity, working for a client. That not professional overall, being a lawyer.
Hear about it in the street.
Yeah.
Be retained by this person.
Yeah.
I'm not sure that it would be covered by solicitor client privilege. I mean, somebody else could report, but I don't know if you could.
So there are two different things. There's confidentiality and privilege. And those actually are two separate issues. Privilege protects evidence in court and says that certain things won't be introduced as evidence in court. Confidentiality is a broader duty to keep things quiet. And confidentiality will only pertain to items that I find out in the course of my relationship with him directly and not things I hear in the street. That's my understanding because, well, let's see the LSUC document here. Take a look at what I've read here in 12 to 14. Because I think that'll inform the discussion. In source number 12, this is from commentary to the rules of professional conduct explaining the issue of confidentiality. A lawyer cannot render effective professional service to the client unless there is full and unreserved communication between them. At the same time, the client must feel completely secure and entitled to proceed on the basis that without any express request or stipulation on the client's part, matters disclosed to or discussed with the lawyer will be held in strict confidence. The client has the right to expect that he doesn't have to say, "Don't tell anybody." It's understood that you will not tell anybody whatever he tells you, because otherwise you will not have a system of representation. Clients will not be honest with their lawyers. So that's the motivation behind the confidentiality protection. Now take a look at the application in source number 13. A lawyer may disclose confidential information, note the word may, that's what I was saying before, but must not disclose more information than is required. When the lawyer believes on reasonable grounds that there is an imminent risk of death or serious bodily harm, and disclosure is necessary to prevent the death or harm. Death, serious bodily harm, and as I mentioned before, serious bodily harm has come to include serious psychological harm as well. You're allowed to, you're not obligated to. And the idea here, very simply, is that it's a moral necessity to say people are allowed to divulge this. In the event that you told lawyers you can't divulge this, you would create an unworkable system. A person can't operate knowing that someone's about to kill somebody else and he's not allowed to say anything. However, they don't want to make it an obligation to do so. You say, may. You're entitled to. I should note that in Ontario, we discussed this also in the confidentiality talk, there is no duty to rescue. So that whole idea that I know someone is in danger, I have to do something for them, is completely irrelevant in the province of Ontario.
Say that part of this rhetoric, may, as opposed to shall, is wrong. It's morally wrong. And I expect that if a lawyer cannot disclose a minimal amount of information to save a life, that a lawyer could be sued. I think there is a duty to prevent that. I'll give you a substantive example.
Okay.
Your client is a bit of a loose cannon. He makes a threat or implies to you that he's going to deal with the other lawyer in court. He's going to deal with his wife in court. And after this happened a number of years ago, when the court was at 145 Queen Street, in that situation, as a lawyer for that client, I must inform security.
So
I don't have to give them all the details. I do have to make sure that there is an armed police officer in the courtroom. And I think I do have to make sure that the security people at the entranceway have a photograph of my client saying, check him carefully.
So I would like to see background on that, because this has been a much debated topic. What he's saying is, what Yafil said is, that there was a case that he's familiar with in which, if I'm understanding you correctly, one spouse made clear to his lawyer that he was planning to do something violent to his wife in court. There was some issue between them, and he was going to do something violent to her. And he says that the lawyer was obligated to make sure that there would be a police officer or somebody stationed there with the ability to prevent the crime with a photograph of the person. So I can't speak to that particular case. I'm not familiar with it. But I can tell you this has been hotly debated, and what I'm saying to you does seem to be the conclusion that, no, you're not, you are not under an obligation, and you cannot be sued for failing to disclose it. I don't know if your case is different because it's in the court. I don't know if that changes anything. But yes. Leah, you were going to say?
Just the fact that it says may is something that I do personal injury work, so there are people who are very angry at the person who injured them, and have, when that person does make a threat against the guy who hurt them, we've been relying on the fact that it's permissive but not required to, who do I have to inform? Do I have to inform their lawyer that prejudices my client's case?
Mm-hmm.
Do I have to inform the defendant as an individual? I'm not allowed to contact them. Do I have to call the police about it?
I think one of the reasons why it's may and not must, and one of the reasons why Ontario doesn't have a duty to rescue, is because those questions are very challenging. And once you create a must obligation for people to report, then the question becomes, have I done enough in reporting, and did I tell the right person, and what if I didn't tell the right person? I suspect that's why it remains a may rather than a must. I take just, there was a hand in the back, and then just the, in the interest of time, I need to make sure to move forward a little bit. Yeah. Right, but your answer is still going to be. Yeah. Right, but I'm fairly sure that there is, because the Law Society says to you may, and because there's no duty to rescue in Ontario, I don't see how one could be vulnerable to suit, but I'm not a lawyer, and I defer to lawyers on this.
I actually had this situation where, just what you described, exactly the same.
Yeah.
I called the Law Society anonymously. I mean, you know, as a lawyer, but not discussing.
Yeah.
Said, this is a situation, what is my obligation? They said, you absolutely have to report it.
Interesting.
They had armed guards there.
Very interesting. Okay. Practical case. I'm not going to go into more cases. Once we've heard from someone who had a case and called the Law Society, I think that says something. Although, again, there's an awful lot of debate in the literature on this word may, and they very solidly said, we're not making this must, we're making this may. So I'm not sure.
I can attest to that. I took a class. I was very shocked. It's a may.
Yeah. I'm going to go a little further, though, with this, just because there's more to see. The obligation is, my primary duty is to the client, barring the possibility of death or serious bodily harm. Now, there is a duty which can override this. There is a duty which can override this, and this goes back to the question of allowing it to go on, allowing dishonorable conduct to go on. If you take a look at source number 14, also from the rules, in acting as an advocate, the lawyer shall neither assist nor permit dishonest or dishonorable conduct. This is talking about in court. The lawyer's duty to the court will supersede. So if the lawyer knows that his client is intending to perjure himself, right, at that point the lawyer does have an obligation to withdraw, to let the judge, I don't know exactly what the lawyer will do at that stage, but the lawyer does have to act. If you take a look at source number 15, from the Legal Research Guide to Ethics, the lawyer is an officer of the courts. A lawyer, when acting for a client, has a prior and perpetual retainer on behalf of truth and justice. And there is no crown or other license which in any case or for any party or purpose can discharge him from that primary and paramount retainer. And that's what obligates him in a court scenario to report or to otherwise thwart dishonorable conduct, as it's termed here. Moving over to the Jewish tradition side, we've said now that from a Law Society perspective, I'm not allowed to prevent unless I'm in the serious bodily harm category. In the serious bodily harm category, it's a may with the caveat that it might be a must based on that particular case that was mentioned. There is also a must obligation to thwart it if it's in the court, in the operation of the court itself. From a Jewish law perspective, I am absolutely religiously obligated to prevent harm. This goes in two directions: harm to the victim and harm to the criminal. If you take a look at source number 16, this is the classic source on the topic. Minayin l'roa es chaverishu toveya benahar. How do I know that if you see somebody else drowning in a river, o chaya gorarto, or being dragged by a wild animal, o listin bayin alav, or attacked by bandits, shu chaya v'hatzilo, that one is obligated to save him? The Torah says, lo sa'amod al dam rayacha, you shall not stand by the blood of your peer. Someone else's blood is being shed, you're not allowed to stand by and do nothing. There is an obligation to intervene. And this will supersede other religious obligations. Not all, but almost all religious obligations. Now, here, we've only given life and death scenarios, it seems. However, I'm not going into this in great depth because we did this in the confidentiality lecture. There is some debate as to whether this includes financial harm or not. Do I have an obligation to save somebody from financial harm? I believe the general consensus in Jewish law is yes. I have an obligation also to save a person from financial harm. Not only do I have this obligation to the victim, I also have the obligation to the criminal. There is a mitzvah, which I think I brought on the sheet. Yes, if you take a look back at source number 8, I jumped to this before because it really didn't belong back there. Verse in Leviticus, Vayikra, Lo sisna es achicha bilavavecha. Do not hate your brother in your heart. Hocheach tochiach es amisecha. You have to instruct your brother, your friend, Velo sisa alavchet, and do not bear sin for him. In other words, broadly, there's a mitzvah that is called in Hebrew tochacha, instruction, demonstration, usually translated as rebuke, although I don't think that's an accurate translation linguistically. The obligation is to show somebody right behavior. If you know they're doing something wrong, you're supposed to try to help them. Now, the Talmud discusses the application of this obligation, because really, people often don't want to hear it, and people have never wanted to hear it. In Talmudic times, they already observed that no one wants to hear this kind of instruction. So that isn't new. And therefore, the question of how one does it and how one does it well is an open question. But what I'm bringing this for is to demonstrate that there is indeed an obligation to prevent wrongdoing, both as a way of preventing harm to the victim and as a way of keeping people from committing wrongdoing. Effectively, I have an obligation to this person to help him not commit a wrong. The only limitation on this is our obligation to ourselves, which I'm going to come back to in the third sub-question, so I'm not going to open it up right now, but where instructing somebody else, or where preventing a wrong, would cause harm to me. So, for example, I am going to withdraw from working for a particular client, but as a result of withdrawing, I'm going to lose a large percentage of my livelihood. Am I obligated to do so? I'm going to come back to that in the third sub-question. But other than that, I have a religious duty to prevent wrongdoing. So what emerges is both law society and Jewish law are saying you have to intervene to prevent wrong. However, there may be distinctions in that, number one, law society generally says may in the area of serious bodily harm, whereas Jewish law would say must. And also, the law society leaves financial harm and says, no, you don't get involved and you don't disclose that which has been revealed to you confidentially. Whereas Jewish law may say, even in the event of financial harm, you have an obligation to act to save the victim. Now, by the way, saving the victim doesn't have to mean disclosing the confidential information. If you have another way to do it, it's better to do it that way. If you can do it without breaking the confidentiality, all the better. Okay, that's sub-question number one. I'm moving into number two, which is the question of default credibility. I'm approached by a potential client who wants to, and here I'll go back to the trust fund case, he wants to use my trust fund. He doesn't tell me what it's for. I know him because he is my cousin's friend. Am I obligated to do any sort of investigation, or am I able to just assume, looks like an honest guy to me? And this goes back to your question before about Damlikav Zichus, the idea of judging others favorably, and so on. The law society seems to obligate me to investigate. Very strongly, actually. If you take a look at your sheet, it's source number 17, rules 3.2-7.1 and 2. A lawyer shall not act or do anything or omit to do anything in circumstances where he or she ought to know that by acting, doing the thing, or omitting to do the thing, he or she is being used by a client, by a person associated with a client, or by any other person to facilitate dishonesty, fraud, crime, or illegal conduct. If I know, or I should know, that what this person is asking me to do, whether it's my client or anybody else, what they're asking me to do is unethical, inappropriate, going to lead to impropriety, I am not allowed to participate, and I have to move actively to prevent it. Omit to do anything is included there as well. It's very strong. Further, it writes, when retained by a client, a lawyer shall make reasonable efforts to ascertain the purpose and objectives of the retainer, and to obtain information about the client necessary to fulfill this obligation. So I have to, in the beginning, when the client approaches me and wants to hire me, I am obligated to do this this investigating. It's really remarkable. It goes very far, farther than I ever expected. And actually, in the commentary there, on the rules, they bring you an example of sets of red flags in real estate transactions and all sorts of things that are constant red flags, such that you should know that there's something wrong going on, and it's up to you to intervene. Joey. Yeah. So that was asked up here, and I'm going to come to it. Right now we're in the law society mode. We'll get to Jewish law in a moment, or in a couple of moments. But the law society does not have any principle of dan lekav zechut, of judging people favorably. I'm not shocked. You are required, in fact, according to this, you are required to be suspicious. And I'll give you a practical case. And this is the case I mentioned before. It's in source number 18, the top of the third side. This is the case I mentioned earlier, in which there was a law firm that had a trust fund, and somebody came to them and said, we want to put money into your trust fund, and eventually we're going to spend it. Law firm said, okay. They didn't know anything further. The truth of the matter was, though, that the fellow who had the money had come by it via a fraudulent investment scheme. He said he was starting a company to do I forget what, and he found somebody and told him to invest with him. That fellow did not do proper investigation and invested with him. And then, after the fact, when it was disclosed that this fraud had taken place and the money was spent and gone, the fellow who had been the investor came back and sued the law firm and said, you should have known that something inappropriate was going on. Now, he lost the suit. And the reason he lost the suit is because that law firm, while they may have had a rules of professional conduct duty to investigate, had no responsibility to this third party, the investor. They had no relationship with the investor. They didn't know the investor existed. So therefore, the suit was dismissed. But look what the judge says in source number 18, it's paragraph 35 of the ruling. I do agree with Mr. Shurkin's position. Mr. Shurkin is the lawyer on behalf of the defrauded investor. I do agree with Mr. Shurkin's position is that there is at least an argument to be made that the defendants breached the rules. That said, meaning they breached the rules because they didn't investigate where this money was coming from. That said, the breach, if one can be shown, may well go to whether the conduct of the defendants breached their professional responsibilities. But in and of itself, such a breach does not generate proximity to the investor, where none exists. It strikes me that the defendants may not have taken all the care they should have to avoid being duped by an apparently unscrupulous client. Like Grace J. in Bruno Appliance and Furniture, Malloy J. in Brunt versus Yen, I find the actions or inaction of the defendants troubling, but there is no basis to find they owed a duty of care in these circumstances. He says in these circumstances because he posits another case in which the fellow who put the money in the trust account actually brought his investor to meet them, so that their presence actually gave the investor confidence. That will be a different story, but that's not our case here. I add that Scott being the investor, Scott's failure to properly safeguard his own interests provides no excuse for the defendants. The fact that the investor didn't do due diligence doesn't mean that you're okay for not having done your own diligence. So what emerges here is that it's a violation of the rules of professional conduct, or as the judge says here, may be a violation, because that's not the case in front of him. But he says it may be a violation if you don't investigate, even where you have nothing to suspect, where you don't know anything about it. Now, I'm not sure how far this goes. In other words, I can't believe that this imposes a duty on the lawyer to become a private investigator. Every client who comes to me, now I have to go check into their background and go looking at... I think there has to be a limit to it. Examples that are given in the Law Society rules are, if he comes to me wanting to engage in a transaction involving land, so I have to do research and make sure that he's actually the owner of that property. That's an example that they give for what I would be obligated to do. Clear? Yes.
Yeah, I have an example.
You know, I, I,
okay,
I'm going to ask you to hold off on example just because we're about to hit the 1 hour mark and we have an hour and a quarter. And I want to honor everybody's time. If you want to come at the end, I'm willing to stay and discuss. I want to make sure to stick to the time frame. Within Jewish law, it doesn't work this way. It's already been noted that we have a principle called Dan Lekav Zichut, which is that you have to judge everybody favorably. We have to assume the best about people. Now, the truth is, that principle is suspended in the event of harm to yourself. Meaning, your obligation to judge others favorably ends when you suspect that somebody might be putting you in danger. So from that perspective, you're not obligated. However, as a general rule, we do assume credibility, and I'm going to give you an example of this in source number 19. Source number 19 is dealing with an issue of kosher food. The rule is that, as a general rule, items that I know are normally kosher, I can eat at a place where I have no reason to suspect wrongdoing. However, certain items which I couldn't tell from looking at it, whether it is kosher or not, because there's no visual distinction between the kosher version and the non-kosher version. If I have something like that, then in a place where people are known to be careless about those distinctions, I am not allowed to trust them. So again, in the event that the item that we're talking about is an item that I can't tell by looking at it whether it's kosher or not, and second point, I'm in a place where people are careless, then the rule is that I'm not allowed to trust. But other than that, I am able to trust. If you take a look at source number 19, that's a primary source on this from the Talmud, where it says, I'm not allowed to purchase wine. Murias or Muris was a fish sauce that was popular in ancient Rome. It involved decaying fish. I'm not sure why it was popular, but that may have had to do with the fall of Rome. Wine, Muris, milk, a type of salt called salakandri or silakandri salt, chiltit, which was a very sharp herb that they would cut with knives, and the knives may have been used to cut non-kosher food, and gvina and cheese. These are all items which, visually, I couldn't tell whether they're kosher or not just by looking for them. If I am in Syria, which was a location where people were known to not be careful about these things, then I'm not allowed to purchase it unless I'm purchasing it from somebody who is certified as being careful. What's my default in general? Take a look at source number 20, Rabbi Moses Maimonides, who writes the following. One who stays in someone else's house, anywhere, at any time, he says, anywhere, at any time. If they bring him wine, they bring him meat, they bring him cheese, they bring him fish, he is permitted to eat. There is no obligation for you to ask questions. You're fine. Ela yodeya shehu Yehudi bilvad. You just have to know that he's a Jew, and because he's a Jew, he's under these laws, and presumably he's careful about them. V'im huchzak sheino kasher. However, if this person is known not to be kosher, the person is known not to be somebody who's careful about these things. V'lo medakdek b'dvarim elu. He's not careful in these matters. Asur lehit areach etzlo. Then you're not allowed to stay there. And if somebody transgresses and stays there, then he's not allowed to eat the meat, the fish, and so on, unless he has certification that this is kosher. So Maimonides articulates the principle very simply. He says that the false assumption is that people are careful unless you have reason to suspect otherwise, and this is what is known in the terminology of Jewish law as Chezkas Kashrus, the presumption that one is kosher, the presumption that one is innocent. And that is indeed our default rule. I should note there's a separate issue which he doesn't address here, which is the issue of knowledge. You could have somebody who is careful about things, but doesn't necessarily know all the rules. At that point, they don't have a presumption of kosher, because they may not know what kosher means. But assuming knowledge, then people by default have this presumption, this default idea, that in fact they're good people and I don't need to be concerned. There is a level of certification called chaver. It's beyond the scope of our discussion right now. But the bottom line is that this is an area where I believe law society rules actually actually differ from what Jewish tradition will expect and are more strict than what Jewish tradition would expect. From a Jewish tradition standpoint, I have the principle that was stated before of judging others favorably. I have the principle here of Chezkas Kashrus, the idea that until you know otherwise, you can assume that people are law-abiding people for the laws that apply to them. And I would not have this concern that the Law Society articulates that says you have to investigate every situation that comes up. Yes?
Isn't there a large difference in regard to the Jewish source? You're talking about someone who ingested a food and for their own body. The Law Society is worried about the fact that you have a trust fund with other people's money, presumably your money, and that you're playing fast and loose with other people's money. I think the Jewish perspective talks more about the harm to myself in terms of judging people favorably, whereas the Law Society, and I think justly so, I think I really do agree with the Law Society's position that if you're playing with other people's money, you better be super careful.
Interesting. So the argument that's put forth, just to make sure everybody can hear it, is that the case I gave from Jewish law was a case of harm to myself, whereas the case that's given from the Law Society is talking about harm to clients or harm to other people, investors, whatever it is. I would actually contend that the same presumption of innocence in Jewish law regarding harm to me and kashrut would apply also to financial. I can't prove that. One thing I would note, though, and then I see there are questions in the back. What I'm actually going to do is jump to the third sub-question, and then I'll take questions at the end so that people can leave if they need to leave. But the my feeling is that the my sense is that it would be so regardless. I was about to state a caveat. Yeah, the caveat is that this is where there is such a chazaka, such a presumed status of being innocent. If I am in a community or if I am in a world in which fraud like this goes on regularly, that eliminates for me the chazaka, the presumed status of innocence. So that question of, well, who has this presumed status, particularly when dealing with financial matters, is actually a good question that I think bears examination. But I'm going to jump to the third issue, and then I'll stick around for questions for those who have questions. The third issue is livelihood. Am I obligated to leave my job rather than violate my duties? So I won't open this one to the floor. I'm just going to say what we have in the sources. Take a look at source number 21, where the Law Society says, yes, you have to leave your job rather than engage in it. It's source 21, subject to the rules about criminal proceedings, the direction of the tribunal. Those are laws that relate to withdrawing from serving a client. A lawyer shall withdraw if A, discharged by the client, or B, the client's instructions require the lawyer to act contrary to these rules or bylaws under the Law Society Act, which is the key point for us, and then C, the lawyer is not competent to continue to handle the matter. But the point is B, that grounds for withdrawal, and not just grounds for withdrawal, but the lawyer shall withdraw if the client's instructions require the lawyer to act contrary to the rules of professional conduct. So the lawyer would indeed be obligated to do so under Law Society rules. Under Jewish law, not necessarily. It depends on which duty we're talking about. If it's the duty not to engage in wrongdoing personally, you shouldn't do something bad, then yes, the Jewish lawyer would be told by Jewish tradition, you are obligated to withdraw because we're not allowed to violate a prohibition in order to make money. So I would be obligated then to withdraw. There may be one caveat in a case in which a person will lose his entire livelihood, endangering himself and his family, but barring an extreme case like that, one would not be entitled to engage in wrongdoing personally. When it comes to the duty not to encourage, that's a different story. Because we saw the case involving King Agrippus before, right? We saw King Agrippus is upset. He says, maybe I'm not legitimate. And the response of the response of the sages endorsing him is condemned. But we saw the commentary from Tosfot on that, who says they had the option of being silent. If they were silent, then all would have been fine. Stronger than that, in source 22, I won't read it aloud here in the interests of time, but source number 22 is a passage from that same discussion in the Talmud, which suggests that in this flawed world, flattery is actually permitted. Flattery of someone who's doing something wrong. Why? So as the commentators there explain, the issue is fear of harm. One would be allowed to engage in this encouragement where the alternative potentially is harm to yourself. So there is the possibility that even if you're not allowed to engage in wrongdoing personally for the sake of your livelihood, encouraging it, flattering it, would actually not require that you withdraw. And the duty to rebuke, as I bring in sources 24 and 25, one is not obligated to rebuke in the event that that would cause harm to his livelihood. So if I have a client, and I understand from the client that the client is engaged in wrongdoing, having nothing to do with my services. What the client is doing is a completely separate piece of his operation. We said before that under Jewish law, I have an obligation to rebuke. However, what we're saying now is, if that's going to cause harm to my livelihood, then my obligation to rebuke may stop there. And that's brought in source number 24 from the Shulchan Aruch, the Code of Jewish Law. There, I wouldn't have an obligation. Mind you, as I brought in source number 25, that's only if there is clear danger. If there isn't clear danger, I have to assume that I do have an obligation to try to convince him not to commit wrongdoing. But short of that, I would not. So to sum up what we've said in just a couple of minutes, we began by noting that there's a basic obligation from a law society perspective to help one's client, and from a Judaism perspective, there is a basic obligation to help people in general, as well as the contractual obligation that comes where you've agreed to work for somebody. However, I am not allowed to participate in wrongdoing, dishonorable conduct, unethical conduct, fraud, whatever term we want to put on it, and the various terms have been used. From a law society perspective, I'm not allowed to because of my duties to myself, my duties to the court. Whereas from a Jewish law perspective, it's a religious obligation not to engage in wrongdoing. That brought us to our three questions. What about preventing? Do I have an obligation to prevent it? So from a law society perspective, I'm not allowed to break confidentiality in order to prevent wrongdoing. I have to try to discourage him. But I don't have an obligation to prevent wrongdoing. I may do it in order to prevent bodily harm. The only exception being, if it's in court, like the perjury case, then I would be obligated to actually intervene. From a Jewish law perspective, I am religiously obligated to prevent somebody from harming others, at least in a bodily harm case, and possibly in a financial case as well. Default credibility, the law society says, investigate in all cases. From a Jewish law perspective, there is an idea of chezkas kashrus, the presumption that people are innocent. However, in the event that I have reason to suspect it, then I would be obligated to investigate. And again, what I'll email out afterwards, I want to give a case that involves financial to address that question that was asked. As opposed to the case of kosher food that I gave here, I'd like to send out a case that illustrates this regarding financial issues and other people's money. The third of the sub-cases was the case of endangering one's livelihood for this purpose. The law society seems to be zero tolerance. In the event that they're asking you to participate in wrongdoing, you have to withdraw, or not just participate in, but even encourage, advise, or whatever, all the different cases that were given. In Jewish law, it seems like you would have to withdraw rather than personally commit wrongdoing, but in terms of encouraging it, or in terms of not rebuking, there seems to be more flexibility. Thank you very much. We managed the hour and a quarter. And I will stick around for questions. Thank you.